You're listening to Your Financial Choices on WDIY Allentown. Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. To ensure compliance with requirements imposed by the IRS, we inform you that any U.S. federal tax advice contained in this communication is not intended to or to be used for the purpose of avoiding penalties under the Internal Revenue Code or promoting, marketing, or recommending to another party any transaction or matter addressed herein. This show is for educational purposes only. For advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA and a certified financial planner on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. That's wdiy.org. I want to thank everyone for their pledging during our pledge drive. I sincerely appreciate it. The WDIY sincerely appreciates it. But I really appreciate it because I always have my own personal goals during this hour. And I really thank everyone for coming forward and supporting us in our efforts here. The markets were down today, the Dow closing at 13,077, the NASDAQ at 2981, and the S&P closed at 1408. Last week, through the pledge drive, I discussed a potpourri of sorts, finishing up IRAs from the prior week. We talked about estate planning week. And finally, we talked about charitable giving. This week, we have a guest in the studio, attorney Stan Vasiliadis, to discuss the good, the bad, and the ugly of living trust. So it kind of is piggybacking on estate planning week from last week because we didn't get to spend enough time talking about estate planning. So living trusts sometimes work into our estate plans. So I'm fortunate enough to have attorney Vasiliadis on with us this evening to talk about living trust. So take advantage of this opportunity as well, that if you do have any estate planning questions as well throughout the hour, you're welcome to give us a call. We are live. Neil is in the studio with us this evening, and we'll answer your calls, take your information, and ask you to mute your radio so you can hear us without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics, not specific investments. And while we do typically have a topic each week, you can always ask questions off topic as well. The number to call in this evening is 610-758-8810. And I'm going to repeat that because as we go through the show, one of the things that happens is you might realize you have a question and you want to call in, and I might not be saying the number right away. So estate planning is a very, very important topic. Quite often we get several calls during the show when we discuss matters such as this. So the phone number is 610-758-8810. And we want to get started. Our topic again is living trust, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I would like to introduce my guest this evening. Stanley Vasiliadis is a certified elder law attorney, and he's the only one in the Lehigh Valley. His law firm, Vasiliadis & Associates, has offices in Bethlehem. Stanley represents clients throughout eastern Pennsylvania in connection with long-term care planning, trust and estate administration, and estate and tax planning. He will discuss with us today what you need to know about living trust, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Welcome back to the show, Stanley.
Great to be here, Laurie.
Thank you for being here. I appreciate it. We have had Stan on the show before. We talked about, I think last time we talked about elder planning more. Was it long-term care?
I think long-term care planning.
Okay, long-term care planning. So tonight we're going to discuss living trust. But before we do that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became involved in elder law planning?
Well, there's a story to that. I am a Lehigh Valley native. My wife, Eugenia, and I raised our family here in the Lehigh Valley, and I got my start here as a lawyer in the Lehigh Valley, initially as a general practitioner. And that was fun. You know, we got to do all kinds of things, and I get to grow in the practice as I was getting older and more mature. And there came a point about 20 years ago when my Aunt Irene, elderly widow, had a stroke, or broke a hip initially, and ended up in the nursing home, and then subsequently had a stroke. And poor Aunt Irene never did make it back home. She spent 7 years, the last 7 years of her life, in skilled nursing care. And she was not a happy camper. Her benefits didn't last very long, Medicare. And I watched her lose everything that she and her husband had spent a lifetime pulling together. She was not a wealthy lady, but she did have some money set aside, some modest investments. And, you know, I was an experienced attorney at the time. I've been around a long time. And I didn't know what to do and to protect what she had. And really nobody did. And that's how I got into the field. At the time, elder law was, I don't know if it even existed or whether it was known as such. So we kind of got in on the ground floor. And really from about 1990 through the mid to late 90s, by the end of that period, my practice had evolved into exclusively doing elder law, which, in addition to traditional estate planning, involves issues that are germane, that relate to the elderly or incapacitated people of any age, including long-term care planning, which focuses on things like housing and protecting someone's assets, qualifying for needed benefits so that they don't become impoverished like my Aunt Irene. And it's a very happy type of practice. I have to say there's a story that I sometimes tell that before I got into elder law, I did a lot of different things, including some trial work. And I once represented a brother who sued his sister. He was swindled out of his inheritance. And we went before a jury, and in order to win, I had to persuade the jury that this lady, his sister, was a liar and a cheat. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the trial, we got a verdict, and we won. And my opposing counsel, another trial lawyer, came up to me and gave me the best compliment that one trial lawyer could have given to another in that circumstance. And he said to me, "Stan, congratulations. My client thinks you're the worst person in the world." And I said, "Thank you." And I took it as a compliment, and it was meant as such. Well, now when the kind of work we do as elder law attorneys, at the end of the representation, as often as not, more often than not, the clients will say, "Thank you for taking this burden off of my shoulders and making it bearable and helping us get through this." And that's really a lot more gratifying than being the worst person in the world.
Feels a lot better. Well, Stan, I know we're going to talk about trust, but I want to just piggyback something on what you mentioned about the elder law planning, because I know that was the direction your practice ended up going. And I know that some of that planning involves trust, which we are going to talk about. But one thing that some people, I think, need to be reminded of, and it's all about education here, and they need to be reminded that sometimes when people need skilled care, it's not covered by their insurance. And that's why they need to do this planning. Sometimes people end up in a nursing home and they're not going to have health insurance. People think health insurance covers everything that could incapacitate someone, and it's not.
Well,
and that's why we go through the assets, right?
Think about this. Here in the Lehigh Valley, Laurie, 1 year of nursing home care costs over $100,000, and Medicare and health insurance do not pay for long-term nursing home care. So what would $100,000 a year of unexpected medical costs not covered by any insurance due to the retirement plan of most of our seniors. Very few can avoid financial impoverishment if you do not qualify for Medicaid benefits, which will cover the cost of long-term care in a nursing home for as long as one lives without any dollar limits or time limits. But the catch is that you've got to be broke to qualify. And part of the planning process, in addition to the traditional estate planning that we do for our clients, is the long-term care planning, which in that context is a way of preserving a substantial part of one's estate for a spouse or eventually for children or other heirs, and still being able to qualify for benefits. And that involves trusts, different kinds of trusts than we'll talk about today, and gifting and annuities and all kinds of planning devices. And I guess that's a topic maybe for another day, because we do have some very good strategies we'd love to talk about.
Okay, folks, I'm going to give you the phone number one more time, and when we come back, we're going to start our discussion about living trusts. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
This is Bill Ultramont-Smith, WDIY's Executive Director. Thank you to everyone who supported WDIY during our fall membership drive. This was an excellent membership campaign. We had set an ambitious but necessary goal of $60,000 that we came within about $3,000 of meeting as we shut down the phone lines at 6:30 p.m. on Saturday. If you missed contributing and would still like your donation to be thanked by having a food donation to Second Harvest Food Bank, please pledge at wdiy.org before the end of October. Thanks from the staff, board, and volunteers at WDIY.
Okay, welcome to the show, and that's good news to hear on that break, that if you have not renewed your membership, or you want to become a new member, or you want to make an additional donation to WDIY, you have until the end of October, and then your gift or donation to the station will serve an extra benefit by donating cereal to Second Harvest Food Bank from, I believe, the store was Price Mart?
Price Right.
Price Right. I apologize. Price Right. So, if you haven't donated, you still have time. WDIY.org. Welcome back to the show, folks. This is Lori Siebert, and I have with me in the studio this evening attorney Stanley Vasiliadis, and we are discussing living trust. Stan also concentrates the practice, if we can say that, with attorneys in elder law planning, and that encompasses quite an array of other services having to do with your estate planning, which may also include trust. But at the same time, Stan, basically people need some basic set of documents, and pretty much everybody needs this basic set of documents. Whether or not someone needs a trust, you'd have to work with your attorney to decide if a trust is applicable to you, and I'm sure we're going to be going through that in the show. But really fast, let's just say basic documents that everyone really needs.
Last will and testament, durable general power of attorney, that is a power of attorney for financial affairs, health care power of attorney, and statement of health care treatment instructions, more popularly known as a living will.
Okay. So if any listeners out there don't have those array of documents, it's really important that you take care of that. Otherwise, you're leaving it up to the powers that be, and your wishes may not be followed the way that you had wanted. And I always say, if you don't make a decision, you really have made a decision. And the decision is you're letting other people decide. So now let's get into our talk about living trust. And folks, again, if you have questions this evening, give us a call, 610-758-8810. It's a lot more fun for us as sitting here in the studio to get those calls, get those questions, and have real life examples. So we appreciate the calls. You could call in and talk live on air, or give your question to Neil and he'll bring it in to us and we'll answer it on the air when we have a chance. So Stan, let's talk about trust. In particular, though, we're talking about living trust. So what is a living trust for people to understand in basic terms?
Well, Laurie, as you know, and I know you're familiar with trusts, there are all kinds of trusts. The so-called living trust is a very well-known and popular type that we're focusing on today, but I think we have to first try to describe really what is a trust. And the ironic thing is you will not find a definition in the Uniform Trust Act that Pennsylvania and many states have adopted, nor really in the common law, which is the basis for our law in the English and American legal tradition, because not all law is written down in statutes. A lot of it has evolved over hundreds of years. So let me try and describe what a trust really is in as simple terms as I can, and then see how the living trust, which we're going to talk about, fits into that. A trust, I guess the best way to describe it is an arrangement between someone who owns property, and when I say property, that could be any type of asset, real estate, including one's home, cash, investments. It could be a car or furnishings and household goods or collectibles. So someone who owns property of any type transfers ownership to someone called a trustee, who becomes the new owner of the property, but who holds and manages and distributes the property in accordance with terms and conditions that are set forth in a trust instrument. So the trustee, although the new owner, cannot just do whatever he or she, or in the case of an institution, trust department, what have you, wants to do, they are limited or restricted insofar as what the restrictions are. And those could be many different types of things. And there's a third party involved here, the owner, who we refer to as the grantor or settlor of the trust, the one that settles the trust or who takes property and transfers it to the trustee. Then we have the trustee, who manages the trust. And the trustee is there to distribute and manage the trust for the benefit of designated individuals who are listed in the trust instrument called beneficiaries. So you've got the settlor, the trustee, and the beneficiary. And there's all kinds of reasons for trust. Just very quickly, if you want to pass property on to your children and they are still minors, then it would not be appropriate and feasible for them to be the owners. It would then be appropriate to have a trustee to hold that property for their benefit in accordance with the terms that you set forth.
Like your Lamborghini or something like that.
If you have a beneficiary, let's say a son or a daughter, and they just are what we refer in the law as spendthrifts, and they're going to blow through that money, or maybe they have a problem because they're gamblers, or maybe they're drug addicts, or maybe they just don't know how to manage money wisely, you may want to provide for them, but instead of giving it to them, you put it into a trust. And the trustee holds and manages and under the conditions that you have established, and that can continue long after you're dead and gone.
Because your spendthrift child may have creditor problems. So it's not only protecting them from blowing through the money, but it might protect somewhat from credit.
Exactly. And okay, that's the third one that I was going to give as an example.
Oh.
And there are many other examples. But the third one is you may have a beneficiary, a family member, who is perfectly capable of managing their affairs, but they're at high risk for being sued mm-hmm. in certain types of jobs or professions. And so you want to make sure that you can pass on the property to them, but that it will remain available even if they are sued. And you can do that when you create a trust with your money for the benefit of someone else. You can't just do that, however, for yourself. You can't take your own money and put it in your own trust and benefit and then be protected from your creditors. It doesn't work that way. So what about a living trust? Living trust is kind of unique in that the settlor, who is providing the property that funds the trust, and the trustee who receives the property and the beneficiary are all one and the same.
Okay. That is where we're going to stop and take a quick break. So, Stan, that was a great definition of the broad view of trust, and it's exactly how I like to do things on the show. We try to give the big picture, and then as we go through the show, we're going to get into more of the details and why it's very important that people understand this enough to know when they need help. Folks, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Welcome back to the show, folks. The phone number this evening is 610-758-8810. I want to remind people, if you have questions, please call in sooner than later, because sometimes if I get all the calls in the last 10 minutes, we can't take all the calls. And people like to stay and listen, and they're waiting, thinking they're going to take their, you know, call in their question a little bit later. Don't feel bad about interrupting us, because sometimes your question will be the information that we were ready to cover anyway. So if you have questions, call in 610-758-8810. Stan just gave a good description of trust in general, broad view, and then gave us at the last minute before I cut him off, the general terms of a living trust. So we had trust being an arrangement. Someone owns property. They transfer that ownership to a trustee. The trustee now becomes the owner and manages and distributes that property as set forth in this trust document. What makes those kind of trust different than a living trust? What makes something a living trust, Stan?
Well, when you talk about living trusts, one then questions, well, are there then dead trusts? they're not dead trusts. They're terminated trusts. A living trust means that it is created by someone who is alive, and the trust goes into effect while the settlor, the creator of the trust, is still alive. Well, how else do you create a trust? How else could you? Well, you could do it through your will. And that's the other big category of trust. So you have living trusts that take effect immediately during the lifetime of the settlor, and testamentary trusts, which are part of one's last will and testament, which are part of one's will, and after the individual who signs the will dies and the will is probated and takes effect, the trustee is one of the beneficiaries of the estate and receives as part of the estate distribution the assets of the trust. And so the trust then takes effect and begins after the individual dies.
I think I'm going to start calling those testamentary trusts the dead trust. it's much easier to understand, because we talk about living trust, we have dead trust. We do have a caller on line one. We have Mike. Mike, can you hear us?
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good. How can we help you? Thank you for calling, first of all. How can we help you?
Hey, you're welcome. My situation is this. It's an elder care question. Though not on living trust, I'm a professional procrastinator, and I have not gotten around to putting my living trust together. My wife is well-employed with a very good Cadillac insurance policy, which I am part of. I am due to start on, I'm going to be 65 next year, and I was wondering if it would be appropriate to ask how to properly integrate my coming into a Medicare situation with her good insurance policy in such a way that when she retires, I am properly covered.
First, Mike, before Stan answers this, what kind of insurance? You're saying she has the Cadillac insurance. Are you talking about long-term care insurance?
It's a Capital Blue Cross policy that she has through her work, and it's a very, very good policy.
For long-term care, though?
I don't know what it covers, and I doubt if it covers long-term care unless it's invoked in the process of, you know, an accident or something while she is employed.
Okay. Well, go ahead, Stan. Do you have some suggestions?
Sure. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Very likely that Cadillac policy that your wife has will not cover long-term care. I'm sure that it won't. Medicare.
I'm assuming that also.
Yeah, Medicare and health insurance cover acute care, which means short-term. You get sick,
right.
You go to the hospital. You get well, you go home. You get sick, you go to the hospital. You die. once it becomes clear that, and sometimes you go into a nursing home to rehab. And the Medicare and the health insurance that supplements it will cover that short term. Once it's clear, however, that this is going to be long term, indefinite, possibly permanent, that's when that health insurance as well as Medicare cuts off. So what you need to look at, Mike, and you and your wife, assuming she's comparable age to you, are if your health is not bad, if reasonably good, you should look at purchasing long-term care insurance, and that would be what you need to be looking at doing. For people in their early to mid-60s, that could be an ideal age for qualifying and buying, because the longer you wait, the
more
expensive it is, and you know there might be a condition that arises that will then preclude you from getting it. So, Mike, that's what you need to do.
I assume that you're probably at some, not at complete liberty to name names, but how do you consider the AARP in terms of finding such a policy?
I'm not aware of AARP having any type of connection with long-term care insurance, so I don't. You know, you could inquire with them, but I'm not too confident that they might be able to give you an answer. What you need to do is talk to some advisors. There are any number of people with insurance backgrounds who deal in this product, and they can tell you who the carriers are. I will say that the number of companies who now offer long-term care insurance are shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
They're leaving the market because
it's too expensive.
It's too expensive, and that's because so many of the people who got the insurance actually need to use it.
Yeah.
And the companies have underestimated what the usage would be. And so, you know what? Get it while you can. If you buy it and you can afford possible rate increases. It's not supposed to go up, but it does from time to time if they get permission. That's something you should get while you have the chance, because in the next 5 years, I'm not sure how available it will be.
That's scary, but thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, Mike, thank you for calling. I appreciate it. Folks, if you have questions this evening, you can give us a call at 610-758-8810. We're talking about living trust and elder care planning from time to time as we go through the show. Living trust, how does someone set up a living trust, Stan? And we have about a minute before the break, and we can always come back to it at the end of the break, but let's set it up before we go.
You know, it's pretty much like writing your will. And in fact, the living trusts serve as will substitutes, because in addition to establishing the framework of how the assets will be managed, all trusts must terminate at some point unless they're charitable. And when the individual that sets up the living trust dies, then the property passes just like as if it were a will. So you need to go to your lawyer and discuss whether a living trust is the tool for you.
Okay. Folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about a little bit more of the details with that. And we are taking your calls, 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Welcome back, folks. I have in the studio with me this evening attorney Stan Vasiliadis from his law firm, Vasiliadis & Associates in Bethlehem. And Stan is a certified elder law attorney, and he's the only one in the Lehigh Valley. We're talking about living trust and estate planning in general. If you have questions this evening, you can give us a call at 610-758-8810. 610-758-8810. So the beauty about trust is there, it's a way for people to control kind of assets that they want to pass to particular people, and they can name someone to kind of help with the administration of those assets that they transfer and the disposition of those assets, whether it's income or principal over someone's lifetime, et cetera, et cetera. Living trust, Stan, you described as being done while you're alive. Some people set up trust through their will. That's called a testamentary trust. We're talking about trust that people set up while they're alive. And the advantages and disadvantages to that is something I want to talk about next. And is a living trust for everyone? When we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, we've seen organizations come into town and say, hey, everybody, come to our seminar, and we're going to sell everybody a trust because everybody has to have one. I would imagine not everybody has to have one, but they're certainly applicable for a lot of people. So can you kind of go through maybe the advantages and disadvantages and maybe highlight, you know, where it makes sense for people?
Sure. Why, Laurie, a living trust in the kind that we're talking about will typically be revocable. So they're also referred to as revocable living trusts, because you can also set up a trust that's not revocable. So the beauty and the attractiveness of a living trust or revocable living trust is that in terms of advantages, you have basically the same advantages as someone who still owns the property. So on the one hand, you're technically not the owner, but on the other hand, you retain the advantages. So what am I talking about? You retain control over the property. In many trusts that are set up, especially irrevocable trusts, you have to forfeit some or all of your control over the property. But in a revocable living trust, whatever authority you had when you owned it in your own name, you still can exercise the same authority under the trust. If you want to cancel the trust and take the money back into your name, you can cancel it. If you want to modify the terms of the trust, you can do that at any time. You don't need the permission of a court to do it, so that you retain full control over the assets. And, of course, because of the fact that you retain full control, you retain full access. You can receive all of the income. You can dip in and take out all of the trust fund. You could actually take all the money out of the trust and just use it up on the day after you do the trust. And there are certain income tax advantages that someone has when they own property that are not available in a lot of other kinds of trusts. But if you have a revocable living trust, you're the one that funded it, you're the trustee, you're the beneficiary.
So the income tax consequences are strong.
The taxes, first of all, the taxes flow to you. And that could be an advantage because in many trusts that are not revocable living trusts, if the trust is taxed as a separate tax-paying entity, that could be a little more cumbersome in terms of having to have a separate tax return. And to the extent that income does not pass through the trust to the owner, and it always does in a revocable living trust, but in many other trusts it doesn't. And trusts are taxed, have the same tax rates as individuals, but you hit the higher tax brackets at much lower thresholds. So in order to hit the maximum 35% tax bracket as an individual, you have to have several hundred thousand dollars of taxable income. A trust reaches that 35% threshold at, I think, a little over $11,000.
Right.
So again, there are also other tax advantages, but to summarize, the advantage is it's you retain full access and control to the extent, the same extent as if you still own the property, and no other kind of trust can duplicate that.
Okay, I want to give the number again, 610-758-8810. If you have questions, give us a call, 610-758-8810. So, Stan, if someone, if putting the assets in the trust it mirrors almost me owning everything still individually, let's talk about the advantages of why we would put it in the trust then.
And that's a good question, because it begs the question, if you are basically treated as still owning the assets, well, why do you do it, and why do you have to do it? Because you know it's going to be more expensive and more involved to set it up and to maintain it. Well, because there are most people, and this is really part of the ugly, of the good and bad of the ugly. We talked a little about the good. Part of the ugly is that most people today in this country who have living trusts, these revocable living trusts, get them for the wrong reasons. There are three big advantages that are touted for why you would want to take property out of your own name and hold it as a trustee. And the biggest, I would call these bogus or false advantages, and the biggest bogus advantage is that this way you get to avoid probate. And that means, well, it's better than having your property pass through a will and be tied up in an estate. Why not just have it pass, have the trustee turn around and when you die and distribute it? Well, here's the thing. There are some states, such as California, at least years back when I talked to one of my colleagues, where it, initially it was harder to distribute an estate to probate because you needed to get a lawyer, you needed to go in court in front of a judge. You had to wait a month before you could even start getting your hands on the property as a, as an executor to start managing it. Whereas with the trust, they didn't have that. But in most states, including Pennsylvania, the initial step of probate is actually pretty easy. You go to the register of wills in the county where the decedent lived with a death certificate and the will. The executor and the lawyer present themselves, and it may take 15 minutes to get started. The hard part about probate is everything else that follows. And we have rules that over the years have been laid down to protect beneficiaries, to protect creditors, to ensure that the government gets its due through taxes. So those are the onerous requirements that are involved with an estate passing, assets passing through an estate with a will. What you need to understand is that those requirements apply to trusts as well, including revocable living trusts.
Right.
So you've got to, the trustee has to give notice to beneficiaries now under a revocable trust, just like an executor of a will does. A trustee has to gather up and safeguard the assets, provide values, give statutory notices to beneficiaries, to pay the taxes and debts, provide accountings to beneficiaries, make distributions, get releases. All of that kind of stuff that you got to do through a will, you got to do through probate.
So we're going to have to ask the question. I have a caller on the line, but when we come back from the caller, we're going to have to ask the question again then, what are the advantages of the living trust? If it's very similar now to If the ugly is you don't put everything in trust just to avoid probate, that might not solve the matter you're trying to avoid. So we're going to talk about some of those other advantages of having assets in a living trust after we take the question from our caller. We have Mary on line one. Mary, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good, thank you for calling. What's your question?
I have a question about trade on death, T-R-A-D-E on death. What are the ramifications if you have funds in an investment account that are non-qualified,
mm-hmm.
and you want to move them on to your heirs? What are the Pennsylvania ramifications of taxing, et cetera?
I think what you're referring to, Mary, is transfer on death or payable on death.
Yes.
And in Pennsylvania and in some other states as well, you have the option as the owner of securities to designate that when you die, it will pass to whoever you designate as a beneficiary. Kind of like the way you do with life insurance or the way you do with assets in an IRA or other qualified retirement plan or deferred annuity.
Right.
So the ramification is that it will not be subject to, it will not pass through the will. It will pass to the named beneficiaries. But it's not quite that simple in this sense that there's going to be a Pennsylvania inheritance tax that will be owed on those securities. So somebody's going to have to file that return. And it brings up this important point about when you do your planning, whether it be with wills or revocable trusts, not everyone's assets nowadays especially pass through the will. You may have the majority of your assets pass outside the will, not only because they're in a revocable living trust, but because maybe they're transferable on death, or maybe you have a lot of your assets in that IRA or life insurance or deferred annuity. All of these are examples of assets that pass outside of the will. So when you go to get your affairs in order and you get that will done, what we emphasize, and I'm sure most attorneys would emphasize, is you've got to coordinate your beneficiary designations with what your will says. Because if your will says, I want to give everything in equal shares to my three children, but then you've got 75% of your assets in IRA or annuities or life insurance or other assets that don't even pass through the will, if that doesn't say the same thing, and, you know, you'll be surprised how often the beneficiary designations don't jive with the will, then you really haven't done your planning. So transferable on death would not pass through the will. It would you could, if you had a revocable living trust, one of the things that you do is you want to make sure that those types of assets that might not be in the trust pass to the into the trust to be distributed the way it would through your will.
So could you name, Stan, Mary, if you don't mind my asking, can you name a trust as the beneficiary of a transfer on death account? I've seen transfer on death to, like, children.
Yes.
I've never seen one to the trust. So if you have a trust, you could do that.
You could do it, but I don't know that it has ever done. It wouldn't make sense.
Yeah. Mary, did that answer your question, or did you have a follow-up on that?
No, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling. We're coming up on our last break. Stan, we have about a minute before we go to that. Folks, I want to remind you, if you have questions, the phone number this evening is 610-758-8810. And I also want to mention that my mother, I think, is listening this evening. My mother from Michigan, who I talk about quite frequently. I hope she's smiling hearing me talk about her. Stan, real quick, just to give an example of this living trust issue, like you said, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and one of the uglies was sometimes people will say, oh, you have to have a trust to avoid probate. This people were bombarding my mother in Michigan, friends of hers. You know, they get in the quilting circle and they say things like, oh, you need a trust. Do you have a trust? And people really need to talk to their attorneys, don't you think? I mean, they're so persuaded by their friends or the neighbors. And
here's part of the ugly as well. A lot of times people will sign these trusts. They'll pay substantially more money than, say, simple wills.
Or more money than they'd pay their local attorney, too.
Certainly. And then they don't put their property in the trust, or they only put part of it in the trust. And so that happens so often that any time you're going to sign a revocable living trust, you're going to have a will referred to as a pour-over will, which is going to catch all the stuff that you never put in the trust.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other bogus advantages is privacy. There are public filings when you have a will, but it's the same thing is going to occur with the trust when you file that inheritance tax return. And then one of the big bogus issues is, well, there's no attorney fees. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, many years back, attorneys used to charge on percentages, and most people didn't have all of these non-probate assets like we've talked about. So nowadays, you're not going to find that. And it's, as we said, the work is the same, whether it's going to be a revocable trust, if you're going to distribute it to your beneficiaries, as it is pretty much with a will.
Because there's still an inheritance tax return, because the assets in a living trust that you've maintained control in are still going to be subject to inheritance tax in Pennsylvania. And you still probably have bills that have to be paid that, if you don't have anything in your estate, would still have to probably come out of your trust. So there's still all of the same kind of administration as what Stan's saying. We're coming up on the last portion of our show. So if you have questions, quickly call in 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk and traditional music is a crazy quilt of colors and textures. In the tradition traces its many patterns and designs. Music handed down from generation to generation. In the tradition, Wednesday evening at 7 on WDIY FM Lehigh Valley Community Public Radio.
Okay, welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I have in the studio with me this evening Stan Vasiliadis, an attorney with Vasiliadis and Associates. We're talking about living trust. If you have questions, we have still some time. The phone number is 610-758-8810. And I'll mention the saying that I frequently mention on the show that my mother used to say as we were growing up is, "You could be dead tomorrow." Which is why I think I love working on estate work so much, because I recognize every day that we could be dead tomorrow. And Stan, one of the problems I think many people face is they are frozen in their footsteps about moving forward on their estate planning. But I'm sure that you could attest to the empowerment people feel and the freedom they feel and the gratification they feel when they've done all the proper planning and have worked with their attorney and have properly executed documents, etc. So tonight we're talking about living trust in particular, and we've just gone over the basics of a trust, the nuances of a living trust, and some of the advantages. Let's talk about some of the disadvantages you mentioned.
Well, ironically, the disadvantages are the same that you have if you continue to own the property rather than putting it into a trust. Well, what do I mean? Contrary to popular perception, the revocable living trust provide absolutely no protection against taxes, death taxes. They don't provide any protection against creditors, they don't protect assets from nursing homes because they count. If you want to qualify for public benefits such as Medicaid, if you want to meet the net worth threshold to qualify for veterans benefits, these are going to be countable assets. Irrevocable trusts, where there are restrictions on the control over the assets, on the access to the beneficial use of the assets, that's the price you pay for protection against taxes, against creditors. Those are the kinds of trusts, those irrevocable trusts, where we can actually qualify someone for Medicaid without them having to spend everything like my Aunt Irene. And the trick of the planning that we do as estate planners and as elder law attorneys is, how do we get the assets out of your name into a trust so that you have these protections? But at the same time, if indirectly, if not directly, retain some indirect control and access.
We'll talk about that in just a second. We have a caller on line one. We have Jennifer. Jennifer, can you hear us?
Yes.
Hi,
yep.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Okay, what's your question?
My question is, I'm a co-executor of a will. My mother passed away, and there are two stocks that she had, and the will states that it's supposed to be split between her five children. And I've done the transfer wizard, and I can't seem to get a medallion stamp in order to do it. And I'm wondering, do I have to go through a lawyer? Our other lawyer ran through our $8,000 retainer. So I'm trying to do it on my own.
Well, a medallion signature you can get typically from a brokerage firm or a bank?
No, I went to our bank, and they won't do it because they said they're only medallion stamping my signature, even though everybody else is supposed to sign these transfer forms.
Because you're not running it through the estate?
Go
ahead. Stan's going to jump on this.
You know,
okay.
It can be a real difficult process, even for lawyers, experienced estate attorneys, to try to distribute securities. And what we learned long ago is we just find, and you would find a brokerage firm.
Okay.
They could take the securities under their umbrella. If the assets are in the estate, the executor opens up the account, and then you let the broker do all that. And they're much better at it than you are, or the attorneys for that matter.
Okay.
And you deposit all the shares, and then you distribute are the children?
I don't have the shares in my hand. They're held by the companies. It's only two companies. One of them was a spinoff of the other one.
Okay, yeah. Then what a brokerage firm would do is be send. You would do the stock certificate. The I can't think of what the name of it is off the top
the
of my
transfer?
Head. Yeah, the you're going to sign this. It's held by a transfer agent. You don't have the stock certificates. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. You'd complete whatever paperwork the company has, transfer it into a brokerage account in the name of the estate, and then the children can decide if they want it in kind or if you're going to sell it in the estate. That's a decision usually is provided within the estate document. The will usually will say what management provisions the executor has. Is that correct, Stan? And
sure.
And it'll say whether they can distribute in kind or if you can decide on your own to sell it. And if the kids want it in kind, then the brokerage firm for the estate would have to have instructions from you, the executor, letters of instruction as to how each of their shares are going to be transferred, whether it's in kind to another brokerage firm or whether it's selling and transferring it. But, you know, from an ease of administration for you, it's usually nice if they all decide to do the same thing.
Right, right. Yeah,
so that's one option.
Does it cost money to go through a brokerage firm to do that, to transfer it from, say, it's like CompServe or something, whatever, I don't know what, remember what the name of it is.
Well, I would say if you're just doing it like an in and an out, there may be a fee. You'd have to discuss that with the brokerage firm, whomever you find.
Right.
Otherwise, you get the kids all to go, you know, sign the papers they need to sign and do it that way, too.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
All right. Good luck,
also,
Jennifer.
Also, real quick,
okay.
Can I ask, what is my exposure as the executrix with odd things like jewelry that were never part of her estate, but that I want to distribute to her children?
An executor, just like a guardian or a trustee or an agent under power of attorney, is a fiduciary. That means you have a standard of care. You've got to be honest in the way you deal with the property. You've got to be, you can't be careless.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to follow the rules. And if you don't, and there's a loss to either the beneficiaries or to the creditors, or if there are taxes that are unpaid and you didn't dot your I's and cross your T's, you will be personally liable.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there's provision for posting a bond. Usually, customarily, it's waived in the will.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be careful. And the job of the attorney, you represent the estate. As the executor, the attorney represents you.
Mm-hmm.
The lawyer you have, his job and duty is to you to keep your chestnuts out of the fire, so to speak.
Right.
Okay, Jennifer.
Okay.
Thank you for calling. Good
Thank
luck.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Stan, we have a few minutes left, so I want you to make sure you get the meat of what you wanted to share with us this evening.
Here's a final, very important point. Where does it really make sense to have a revocable living trust? There are situations where it's a great tool to have. I said before that most people get revocable living trusts for the wrong reasons. Well, here are the type of people that really should have revocable living trust. Number one, if you have a lot of money and your situation is such that you don't feel capable of managing it, maybe you're old or maybe you're ill, or maybe you just don't want to have to be bothered with managing your property, you can set yourself up in a revocable living trust, turn the property over to a trust department or other institutional or professional trustee, and they could manage
your funds. Or a family member that you trust.
Now, here's the thing. Ordinarily, if there's a family, and this leads into the other reason, which I think is the big reason. Ordinarily, if you have family members that are willing and able to take care of you, you could simply appoint them as agent under power of attorney.
Good point.
And they can do that. But what about the bachelor who has no relatives nearby, has no one that's really willing and able to step in? You don't name someone as an agent under power of attorney who you don't really know or trust and who's not going to do the job. That's where you rely on a trustee. It's usually going to be an institutional professional trustee, and they will manage the affairs for you. Maybe not immediately. Sometimes you may say, I'm going to be my trustee, but if I become incapacitated and can't care for myself, then the institutional trustee will step in and handle that. And when I die, that trust is like my will. It's going to pass the assets. One other situation. Sometimes if you have real estate in multiple jurisdictions,
mm-hmm.
like the client I had that has a home in Bethlehem, but that spends 7 months a year in Florida and that spends the summer in New Jersey on the shore, and it has a home in each place, mm-hmm. It's a good idea to have a revocable living trust so that you don't have to probate in three different jurisdictions when you pass away.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. We had a caller who called in off air, and I'll take this question very quickly. William called, and he asked, IRA distribution, 401k, and various IRAs in different banks. Can he withdraw his required minimum distribution from just one account? So, William, when we talk about required minimum distributions, we're talking about age 70 and a half. The rules are different for 401ks and IRAs. If you have a required minimum distribution and you have several 401k accounts, you have to take your required minimum distribution from each of the 401k accounts. IRAs in the IRS's eyes are all one. So you could have IRA accounts at 10 different banks and you have the required minimum distribution calculated on the balance of all of your IRAs. You can take the distribution from any one of the IRA accounts. You could take some from each of the 10, you could take some from two, you could take some from one, as long as you meet your required minimum distribution dollar amount in any of those IRAs. The 401k is separate, so you can't combine your 401k and your IRA and take it all out of the IRA. Now, I want to distinguish that between when people roll their 401ks over to an IRA rollover, that's no longer called a 401k. That is also considered an IRA and can fall under the required minimum distribution rules for that. Stan, thank you so much for being here this evening. I'm sorry we ran a little short, but it was great information, and I think you really spelled it out very much in plain English, and I think it really helped people and understand that while you explained it simply, it is actually quite complicated, and it really behooves people to see their attorneys. How do people reach you if they would like to?
We're in Bethlehem, and our phone number is 610-694-9455.
Very good. 610-699.
No, I'll repeat it. 610-694-9455.
Okay.
Thank you, Laurie.
Thank
it was good
you
to be here.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Next week, Rod Young, CPA and CFP, will be the guest host for me. And he will be joined by Jane Hathaway, a mortgage banker, to discuss what's going on in the mortgage market and what do you need to know. Thank you, Jeff, for being here. Thank you, Neil, for being here. Thank you, Stan Vasiliata, so much for being here. We really appreciate your time and your professionalism and your experience. We want you to stay tuned for In the Tradition Folk Music with Tom Druckenmiller. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices, and have a great week.